guest lecturers, the first, Elizabeth Forsthall, and she's also an improv actor, so you might see as or her group around the city. And then seamlessly, after her 25-minute presentation, we'll go to Steve's presentation, which is a more general presentation about science fiction. Okay, so Elizabeth, what's the name of your group again?
Caught in the Act. We're performing June 13th at Muddy Waters Cafe downtown. So if you feel like laughing at me, I won't have finished grading by then. I made up some visuals for my lecture. So in case you get bored with listening to me, you can just kind of stare online. My kind of working title for what I wanted to talk to you guys about is Through the Stargate, Men Become Math. And so Professor Warner has built up to it a little bit so far. A lot of people get really confused about what happens at the end of the book and of the movie, and so I thought that I would offer my take on things. What you know already is that 2001 is about how aliens have helped humans evolve. They use tools to develop abstract thought, and then when the tools become too much, they basically become unnecessary. So in that struggle for power between Bowman and Howe, Bowman won. And at that point, Bowman earned his right to get to evolve further, not needing tools and not needing matter at all. Here's my thesis, bullet point number three. Bullet points number one and two, of course, are facts about the book, evidence. Bullet point number three is more of a thesis-type argument for those of you guys who are concerned about your essay. 2001, Quest version of 2001, is a male fantasy about how you can succeed at spiritual transformation without anything bodily, without any kind of womanness, without a womb. You get to go through death and rebirth and become a totally new spiritual being without doing any kind of earthly work that we think of when we think about spiritual transformation on Earth today. So that's kind of what I'm going to talk about today, and I'm going to go through three things. Quest, God, is mathematics. The monolith, I like to think of the monolith as a male vagina, and unsurprisingly, I'm of the opinion that Kubrick does things way differently than Clark. So that's my thing. Obviously, that's not law, but I'm going to point out some of the differences with respect to these issues about gender and rationality and kind of the history of those things in Western culture. So in part one, Clark's God is Light. God is Light is something that you guys are probably familiar with because most of you grew up in Western culture, and right now you live in Western culture. You think about like Plato's allegory of the cave, and light equals truth for Plato. Plato didn't make that up either. He was working off of other traditions. And you can think of the Old and New Testament, Moses getting proof of divine power through the burning bush. And the burning bush is a sign that it's actually God speaking and not someone dude in a tree because the bush doesn't burn up. And so the fire is kind of the mysterious presence of God. And something that I thought was something kind of cool was a super famous passage from Milton's Paradise Lost. And I don't know how many of you guys are familiar with this, but Milton basically established Western interpretation of Christianity, reestablished it. And God is light, and darkness is evil, and female decision-making is evil. So here we go. Hail, holy light, offspring of heaven first born. I don't think I have time to go through like super close reading of this, but it's something to think about when you're thinking about how the aliens in 2001, both in Clark and in Kubrick, kind of what they're like. My argument is that they are a different kind of light than what Milton's talking about. And you can look at some of this language. It's kind of deliberate ironies, confusing adjectives that contradict each other, like eternal, co-eternal being. Milton's deliberately creating a God is light that humans can't understand. There's deliberate mystery. And of course, Milton's point of view is that we've fallen after the Garden of Eden, and that's why we can't understand God, because we don't live there anymore. And so his use of imagery is deliberately confusing. But if you go back to what Clark does and how he changes this Western tradition, Clark's use of light is super clear, straightforward, understandable. And a lot of you guys will remember the passages in which the monolith gives off light to kind of hypnotize or teach the man ape in Primeval Night. After the monolith drums, it turns into milky luminescence, and of course milk is something kind of feminine. But in the chapter A New Rock, I don't have page numbers for your version, so I'm just going to go by chapters. The wheels of light spin faster, they keep spinning faster and faster, and they begin to merge the spokes just there are these bars and wheels of light and geometrical patterns, and they're kind of dancing. But they have angles of intersection. They split into one each other. They rotate on axes. All these things that you guys are familiar with from basic geometry. And, of course, while this is happening, the monolith is probing the mayonnaise. So we all, we discussed that last week. You're experts on that. But if you look at Milton's version of light, it's deliberately inaccessible. But Clark's aliens kind of turning into light, the light is kind of a symbol for total mastery of the universe and total control. So if you have these kind of simple geometric patterns, those are ways that we understand we can control the universe. And then if you go later, of course, in the book, in the Through the Stargate section, these things get explained a little better. But you may be wondering what God has to do with mathematics, and I wonder that as well. But you've seen so far the evolution of human experience with rational thought and abstract thought, and this is something that we, at least, I know in my sections we talked about this and touched on in lecture as well. And mathematics is like the ultimate abstract thought and the ultimate rationality. And if those of you who are familiar with mathematics know, the further you get on, the less you even need numbers. Even numbers don't matter once you get even into some basic calculus. You're just working with letters. The further you go into math, the more abstract it gets. And pretty soon, you're in this pure world of ideas that don't really have anything to do with things that you can touch on Earth or with people. And so math is totally disembodied. Light is totally disembodied as well. And so a lot of the reasons light has been associated with kind of a divine force is because it's got nothing to do with matter. It's visual, so we can experience it, but we can't touch it. And even in 1900, people knew that light had this kind of tenuous grip on physical reality because it's both particle and a wave. Clark knew all this. And so even a scientific understanding of light that Clark is using understands light as something that has no real material presence. So you've got humans going farther and farther away from the body and from material presence, closer to abstract thought, closer to light. And light and mathematics both represent this kind of ultimate abstraction or ultimate disembodiment, so to speak. Other appearances of aliens as light, the primary explanation in Clark for what the aliens are doing is the chapter called Experiment. It's chapter 37. And Kubrick doesn't give as much explanation of what the aliens are doing. For Kubrick, you have to do a lot of work on your own. You have to just kind of look at what the monolith is doing in the film. But Clark is kind enough to explain the history of the aliens experimenting in the universe. One of the quotes, I can't take the time to do all of them, but this is a way that some of you guys might want to go through your essay. Because in all the galaxy, this is kind of in the beginning of the experiment chapter, because in all the galaxy, they had found nothing more precious than mind, with a capital M. They encouraged its dawning everywhere. They became farmers in the field of stars. They sowed, and sometimes they reaped, and sometimes dispassionately they had to weed. And later on, they learned to store knowledge in the structure of space itself and to preserve their thoughts for eternity in frozen lattices of light. Now, a lattice is pretty clear gridwork structure. It's not at all like an eternal, co-eternal being or a ethereal stream or essence in created. It's not like that. It's just a grid of light. They could become creatures of radiation, free at last from the tyranny of matter. So nice. Into pure energy, therefore, they presently transformed themselves. Now they were lords of the galaxy and beyond the reach of time. They could rove at will among the stars and sink like a subtle mist through the very interstices of space. If you think about your own experiences with math and the sciences, a lot of the kind of characterizations of those disciplines that have come down to us are that math and science, kind of the natural sciences, are ways that we can control our environment. We can create equations to figure out how balls fly through the air so that we can predict them. And a lot of what the scientists try to do is predict natural phenomena. And if you read up on math, or if you've experienced some of these disciplines for yourself, there's a lot of kind of praise of math for its cleanness, and it's peaceful and clean and objective, and people can just manipulate numbers, and there's no friction that involves. The natural sciences aren't as mathematical because they can't be, because the world has friction in it. The world has extra factors and dirt coming in your machine and messing it up. So there's this idea of math is the ultimate way to control, or the ultimate way to be timeless and escape the world and experience something that is totally without emotion and totally immortal. And people people just aren't like that. People die. The world changes. And so you can look at some of the language in Clark, and you can see the freeing from the tyranny of matter that the aliens are doing. They're trying to live forever, basically. I mean, the tyranny of matter is death, in not just my opinion, but that's one way to approach this stuff. So Bowman goes through the monolith and becomes it in Clark. The monolith, the male vagina. You have to go through it to get transformed. First of all, I guess, why is it male? Which is a very good question. And I looked on the web. I couldn't find any really great pictures of the monolith, which kind of bugs me. So there's this little tiny picture of it in Primeval Night. But basically, the ways that it's male have to do with this kind of tradition of disembodiment through mathematics. There's this kind of long-standing cultural message that men think and women feel, that men think rationally, men have rational thought, women experience things emotionally. This stuff is pretty familiar to all of you guys. And it's also been the basis for excluding women from voting, from higher education institutions, from certain kinds of religious practice. It's pretty real. And even when I was 8 years old, I wanted to be, like a lot of people in the Cold War, I wanted to be an astronaut. And I thought, oh no, I'll never be good at science. I can't be an astronaut. But then Krista McAuliffe, the teacher, was going to fly to the moon, and it was like national joy celebration. Everyone was so stoked. But then, of course, the Challenger crashed. And then I decided to be a paleontologist. Didn't want to be an astronaut anymore. So, the maleness of the monolith, first of all, is dimensions of perfect 1 by 4 by 9, the squares of the first three integers, so they're clean and perfect, and the human in 1999, when they uncover it, can't imagine any kind of perfection being created by human engineers. I mean, it's the cleanest use of integers anyone's ever seen in engineering. So it's like perfect mathematics. Also, men, or maleness, is supposed to involve ignoring emotion. And if you go through and you look at the male characters, all of them are fairly dispassionate. And the language involved in describing Bowman's experience when he's traveling through the Stargate, he's dispassionate. They usually say, they use that word a lot. He feels neither hope nor fear. All his emotion has been leached away. He felt a sense of calm expectation. He was not in the least surprised or alarmed. He traveled these millions of miles in search of mystery, and now it seems the mystery was coming to him. And if you go through a lot of the novel, and you look at the people that precede Bowman, Moonwatcher and Heywood Floyd, they seem to me to have a progression of detachment from their physical world and a progression into being more and more advanced with abstract thought. And you get that with Bowman. He's like the king. And as Professor Warner lectured on last week, he and Frank Poole seem to be pretty robotic themselves. Once he gets through the Stargate, you know, the aliens suck out all his memories, so sucking out all his, and a lot of it is like memories of family experiences and stuff. And he's pretty happy about it. He knew all was well, and smiles with fondness and without pain. You can also look at the language of the passage through the monolith. It doesn't affect him physically at all. He doesn't really have any kind of bodily experience. He doesn't have any kind of G-force experience, like his skin on his face doesn't stretch back, like you've seen. He doesn't feel any kind of inertia or anything. He just sees the stars slide by, but the stars ahead don't even move. And that's the extent of his sensory experience of this. And of course, this rational detachment of the body persists even through traveling through this diaphragm-like shaft of the monolith into death and rebirth, which is why I use the word vagina. A lot of language, including like Freudian psychoanalysis, talks about womanhood and the womb, like womanhood equals the womb, and people have to travel back there to go through some kind of transformation. So men get to be transformed through their interactions with women. This is, I don't know, basic women's studies stuff that some of you may or may not be familiar with. So Bowman has to go through this passage. He dies, and then he gets reborn into the next level up of human existence. And it's mysterious. No one really knows how it's done. Women are mysterious. So I think that Clark is doing all of these things. I don't know how conscious he is of doing these things. But you can also look at a little more shallowly at the maleness of it by looking at the way women are depicted in Clark 2001. The stewardesses that provide the comforting presence, they kind of fuss over him meaning Heywood Floyd. There's one stewardess that makes a mistake. He has a charming but embarrassed smile, And there's another stewardess who has a fiancé who's a scientist, and so she's kind of curious about it, but of course she doesn't understand what's going on. There's also, right at the beginning in Primeval Night, the females that I mentioned are either mothers or they eat. Like, the one nursing female picks up the bone, the bloody bone of the animal that they killed and realizes that it's food. She's the one that eats it because she needs to feed so that she can nurse better. But it was an experiment, cause and effect experiment. It wasn't abstract thought. Anyway, I have a minute to talk about how Coover does it differently. First of all, gender is more complicated. You have this kind of fetishized stewardess woman walking through, and the camera is loving the pictures of the stewardesses walking through with their Velcro shoes, and they kind of lurch, though. I mean, they're not at all graceful. They're not at all even, I mean, the extent to which they're feminine is really up for debate. I do have a colleague that said that he thought that stewardesses were fetishized in the movie, but I think that Frank Poole, that opening shot of the interior of Discovery in Kubrick's film, and when we saw it in Lesher last week, with Frank Poole running in the really tight clothes and he's boxing, and he just keeps running, I think that's even more of a kind of loving, fetish-like shot than Kubrick gives on the women. Also, the Russian scientist in Clark's novel on the space station, Kubrick makes her a woman, and she has lots of female scientist friends. That's a touch that some might call trivial, but Kubrick thought it was important enough to change Clark's version of it. Other ways that Kubrick does it differently is this whole stuff about God and aliens being mathematical and light and like perfect angles and stuff. Kubrick just kind of glosses over it if he attends to it at all. I said before, Kubrick doesn't really pay much attention to what the aliens are like. Kubrick's more concerned with the human, and his monolith is not at all given the kind of attention that Clark gives it. Moreover, God's not really disembodied, and if you think about Clark's version of human evolution, where humans at the end become godlike, and Earth is a little toy, the child, the star child, in Kubrick, the star child has a body, and it's glowing, but it looks like human. You know, it looks like a fetus, like a magical fetus with starry eyes, but still very anthropomorphic, kind of shockingly so. Also, another way to look at it is if you think about math and science being a way to escape time, to have these timeless truths of numbers, Kubrick doesn't do that either. He has time being a pretty tangible experience in the alien home where Bowman lands after he goes through the Stargate. There's this kind of disjointed experience of time, but there's very much a sense of this kind of sad and lonely and slightly crazy Bowman aging and almost dying, and really disjunctive, jarring experience. I don't think at all it's the kind of smooth escape that Clark offers. Also, Bowman is totally emotional through the Stargate. Clark has him at peace, mildly curious about what comes next, but this is a pretty good depiction of Kubrick's version of Bowman. He's freaked out, and when he gets out of the lantern, he's shaking and totally freaked out. And I'm out of time. That's my lecture.
Can everyone hear me back in the back? I really, really hate microphones. So. Okay, sort of as a bridge to Elizabeth's lecture, be thinking about the ways in which 2001 Space Odyssey might fit into what I'm going to be talking about, and after I get through what I'm going to be talking about, perhaps we can have a short discussion if we have time to find out whether or not it fits into the concepts that I'll be presenting today. In the first lecture of this course, here, let me get my little multimedia stuff going.
Is it possible for you to wear a microphone?
Yeah, if you want, sure. Is going to be the science fiction and the contact zone. And in the first lecture of the course, Professor Warner advanced the complex question of genre. What exactly is science fiction? And we've gotten a number of different definitions of what science fiction actually is. And a couple of the ones that have been given to me over the course of the quarter have been science fiction is the other. And that's by Jessica Humphrey. She's a graduate student who's going to be completing her dissertation on science fiction. I thought she would be a really good person to go to talk about it. The other definition that's given is by Ursula K. Le Guin in her introduction to The Left Hand of Darkness, and it states all fiction is metaphor, and science fiction, therefore, is metaphor. So I sort of wanted to combine these two different definitions of science fiction in my lecture today. And before going on, it's going to be pretty important to understand some of the terms I'll be using, and for some of you guys, this will be really reductive because you've heard this before. But the other most commonly refers to humans of different backgrounds, whatever that might be, cultural, age, sexual orientation, gender, or race. So that'll be something that you might want to think about when I'm calling people the other. So that's that. Okay, and one of the tools that Ursula K. Le Guin says she uses in science fiction is called the literalization of metaphor. And an example would be the one that I did in this lecture, the comparison of human interaction with other humans to human interaction with the alien other. So in this case, I'm changing the human to the alien, and that's a pretty obvious comparison that you guys have probably already been thinking about during the course. So the human other therefore gets literalized as the alien, and that's sort of the way I want to go with this lecture today. Now I'm going to introduce one of the terms, and if you've taken English 102, you've heard of it before, contact zone. And it states that the contact zone is a social space where cultures meet, clash, and grapple with each other, often in the context of highly asymmetrical relations of power, such as colonialism, slavery, or their aftermath. And that's from Mary Louise Pratt's Arts of the Contact Zone. And I'm introducing this idea because I think it will be really interesting for us to look at the ways that the contact zone gets reconfigured in the books that we've looked and the texts that we looked at this quarter so far. Okay? And so as a jumping off point, oh, and another thing to really think about, to keep in mind about the contact zone, it's really important that you think of it as a dialogue between humans and the other. It's always going to be about some sort of language that develops. And it's often called a pigeon language. And that's basically some sort of commonality between the two different groups. And they come together and they form this different language in order to communicate with each other. Okay? So the idea of dialogue is going to be really important to the context now. Okay? Alright. Okay. Jumping off point for today's lecture will be the Star Trek Prime Directive. And it states that no Starfleet personnel may interfere with the normal and healthy development of alien life and culture. Such interference includes introducing superior knowledge, strength, or technology to a world whose society is incapable of handling such advantages wisely. That's a typo. But you get the picture. So basically what they're saying is that the world that has the more advanced transportation capabilities is going to be the one who is able to initiate contact. And in this specific case, Starfleet cannot go and meet up with other planets who have not achieved space travel on their own. And it sort of brings up this idea of moral obligation in the contact zone. How exactly should we initiate contact, right? And there are different ways that we conceive of this within Star Trek itself. And if you know the original Starship Enterprise credo, there are voyages of the Star. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise for 5-year mission to seek out new life and to go where no man has gone before. It suggests exploration, definitely, a curiosity. So curiosity is definitely a possibility for initiating contact. Of course, this is really a gender statement because it's where no man. So it's important to point that out. But the contact zone could also be a place where you just do it for primarily scientific reasons. If you watch Star Trek The Next Generation, you know the character of Dr. Beverly Crusher. And if you follow her history, she eventually captains her own ship in which she sort of just goes on medical journeys and scientific journeys. And finally, you know the other series called Star Trek Deep Space Nine, that's an intergalactic station. And definitely you can see instances where on the ship itself, there are Cassian Taylors that are doing economic type things. So the contact zone is definitely a place where economic interaction can take place. And that's going to follow a lot with the way colonial interactions take place on Earth. So you can be thinking about why, for instance, the European explorers in the 17th and 18th century even bothered to go look at new lands, right? So if we move on from this, the War of the Worlds, does the contact zone exist in this text? And it's clear that the Martians possess superior transportation technology. They are the ones to come to Earth on their spaceship. And this does allow contact to occur. But I don't want you guys to be confused by the idea of contact versus contact zone. Contact being just the fact that the aliens are introduced to each other, the alien and the human. Contact zone suggests that there has to be some sort of language and some sort of dialogue that occurs between the races. And what dialogue did we have with the Martians in that text? It's really difficult to figure that out, right? I don't remember any instances in which the Martians actually started talking about anything, except for they start saying ula ula at the end of the novel, and the narrator never even figures out what that means. So in that respect, it's kind of debatable whether or not the contact zone exists in this text. But another really interesting thing to think about is, why are the Martians not given a voice in this text? And it definitely contributes to dehumanization of the Martians. And that contrasts very effectively, and it's very diametrically opposed to the idea that the narrative brings up at the beginning of the text, which was the fact that we must remember what ruthless and utter destruction our own species has wrought, not only upon animals, but upon its own inferior races. The Tasmanians, in spite of their own human likeness, were entirely swept out of existence in a war of extermination waged by European immigrants in the space of 50 years. And if we think about that statement, why is there a dichotomy between the narrative's relativist ideas and the seemingly malevolent actions of the Martians themselves? And that question is really hard to answer in this text because we never get a Martian viewpoint strictly from the Martian point of view. They're not given that voice. And once again, it's really difficult to really understand if there's a contact zone occurring until you get both dialogue going on, both sections of dialogue, not only the humans, but also the Martians, okay? And that's just what I wanted to point out with that text. So, the left hand of Dark Moon. The contact zone is established, right, in this text, you know. Genli is the envoy. He's able to establish himself as a sort of tradesman for the Ecumen, which is the Federation of Planets, in that text. And it kind of resonates with Starfleet in that there is this interstellar group of planets working together. But in this case, they clearly don't operate by the Prime Directive. Why? Because they still go to a planet upon which the Githenians don't have the ability to, you know, have space travel yet. So definitely, this text would be violating the Prime Directive. So it definitely, one of the terms that I want to introduce at this point is the idea of the grotesque in literature. And the word origin is from grotto esque. It refers to the grottos in Italy in which paintings were found of humans joined in fanciful and bizarre combinations with animals. And it sort of is this little sphinx right over there, because that's a really good representation of what the grotesque is. That's Oedipus' tale, and she has the body of a lion and the face of a woman. So that's definitely a grotesque imagery. And I'm arguing that for this text, Lewin is using the contact zone as a grotesque contact zone. In the respect that I think the Githenians, in the fact that they have both male and female parts inside their body, becomes this grotesque combination of things that are not commonly put together, the male and the female. And it's a really interesting way of introducing this kind of concept into science fiction. And so, do we see the grotesque in, for instance, War of the Worlds? And we do, because the narrator compares the alien's bulk to that of a bear and conceives a part of the alien's body as a lengthened tentacular appendage, suggesting that it's like an octopus. So we definitely are getting grotesque in multiple texts in this course. The brilliance, I think, of Le Guin's inclusion of the grotesque contact zone occurs in the connection to the conclusion of what happens in the text, because Genly narrates that his human shipmates basically come down on the planet and Their voices sounded strange, too deep, too shrill. They were like a troop of great strange animals of two different species, great apes with intelligent eyes, all of them in a rough rut, and I sort of have this picture of, you know, Planet of the Apes. And it's the idea that there's an inversion of the grotesque here. Who is grotesque? Are the Githenians grotesque, or are the Karhiders, or the humans grotesque? And in this case, it's definitely a reversal. The human himself, Genli, thinks his other fellow humans are grotesque. And in that respect, it's this really interesting inversion. And what can we learn from that? It definitely suggests that Le Guin is definitely making a statement about the constructions of gender bias and how we view concepts of gender. Okay. And one of the last stories that I wanted to touch upon is in your Norton science fiction anthology, and I'm not going to dwell on it too much because I know a lot of you probably have not gotten the chance to look at this in depth, but it's called When I Was Miss Dow, and basically it's about a group of alien shapeshifters, and the humans meet them on a planet coming there because they want to get ore and they want to study this new planet, and these shapeshifter aliens, in order to get the best of the humans, change themselves into humans without the humans knowing it. And these shapeshifters study among them, find out their economic practices and things like that, and use it to their advantage that the humans don't know that they're shapeshifters. And at the end of the text, Martha Dow, who's an alien, she takes the figure of Martha Dow. She falls in love, basically, with the human figure. And one of the things that she says after the conclusion of the novel, or towards the end of the novel, is, "To see the truth, you must have light of some sort. And to see the light, you must have darkness of some sort. I can no longer float on the horizon between the two because that horizon has disappeared." And it's sort of it has a definite connection to the left hand of darkness, and that's the sense that, you know, light is the left hand of darkness. That sort of light and dark imagery is echoed in this passage. But what I want to look at is the idea that this figure can no longer float on the horizon between two because that horizon disappeared. And that sort of suggests that the alien has been able to reconcile both parts of herself, the fact that she is still an alien because she's shape-shifted, but at the same time, she's also human because she's in the human form. And it sort of becomes a really good metaphor as to kind of what this lecture is going for, the idea of how can we not succumb to an extreme relativism, you know, but still say that we're different from another culture. And that's something that we still have to work on today, most definitely. So, to kind of wrap things up here, some general conclusions. The contact zone in science fiction definitely relies on interstellar transportation capabilities, as we've seen. You got to have the best transportation to initiate contact at all. The second one, I didn't talk as much as I could have. The mutual desire to continue contact might seem really obvious, but it's really important because, as we saw in The War of the Worlds, the Martians didn't really want anything to do with the humans except for getting their blood and eating them and nothing much else. So the contact wasn't really established at all. They couldn't really generate anything there. And a dialogue or language between the alien races is definitely needed for it to be a contact zone. So why maintain a contact zone in terms of science fiction? Definitely there's trade benefits, as we've seen in The Left Hand of Darkness, and When I Was Miss Dow. There's definitely scholarly benefits, and that's with the Star Trek. You know, the USS Pasteur and Dr. Beverly Crusher on their ship, and When I Was Miss Dow. Definitely curiosity, and that's one of the first feelings that the narrator gives to seeing the alien upon coming out of the pod in the War of the Worlds. That's always going to be known as a contact zone. Okay? And with the time remaining, I'd like to posit the question that would bridge with Elizabeth's lecture would be, in 2001, do we get a contact zone there? What do people think?
Yeah.
Okay, why?
That the aliens have set up the monolith as the contact zone, and humans obviously are interested in it as well, otherwise they wouldn't have sent that expedition there.
Definitely a possibility. Where's the dialogue? responsibility is, I think it's ambiguous. So anybody else?
Totally. The dialogue is in the evolution itself. I mean, the fact that the real form of time and evolution is again. Yes, the style is into that.
Okay, good.
I was going to say, like, in the Dawn of Man sequence where the monolith first appears on Earth, it's there's a dialogue there, but the intellect level is so disproportionate that it's not necessarily entirely fair. Like, the man-apes are chewing on the monolith and, like, looking at it and touching it, and the monolith is, you know, it's part of the dialogue is that it's reading their minds and going into their thoughts. So it's misdirected, you know?
Exactly.
No, it's not as purposeful or directed as it could be.
Yeah, and it suggests the possibility that language, does it necessarily have to be in a verbal form? Because, you know, when there's a monolith, definitely there's something going on there.
Yeah.
You don't know what you know
the
language.
Like, they're trying to learn about it, but they don't have the intellectual capacity to think on the same level as the monolith itself.
That's it. Thank you.
Ben, quick announcement. Professor Jim Donlan, who is the teacher of science fiction, won the English 192 the last couple of years, will be presenting a lecture on this Thursday, on the Star Trek phenomenon. It's a synthetic overview of the Star Trek. Most of you probably grew up with it and know it very well. However, tomorrow we will have a screening of two episodes that deal with the Borg. The first is the Q Who, and the next is I Borg. So that's 7 o'clock tomorrow in 1960, for those of you who don't know.